Have you ever been in a conversation where you're speaking clearly, yet the look on the other person's face tells you they're completely lost? Alan Alda certainly has, and it nearly cost him his smile. The beloved MASH actor and Emmy Award winner's watershed moment came when a dentist, blade in hand, mentioned there would be some tethering during a procedure. Too intimidated to ask questions, Alda ended up with a severed maxillary labiofrenum that left him with a drooping sneer instead of his trademark smile. This painful experience became the catalyst for his decades-long exploration of communication, culminating in his work at the Center for Communicating Science at Stony Brook University. The book has become required reading in medical schools nationwide, with Atul Gawande calling it thoughtful and enlightening. Through his unique lens as both actor and science communicator, Alda reveals the surprising secret to effective communication. It's not about what we say, but how deeply we connect with the person we're saying it to. Communication isn't just about transmitting information. It's about creating a genuine connection. True relating means becoming so aware of another person that everything about them affects you. Their words, tone, body language, and subtle positioning. Most importantly, it means allowing yourself to be changed by the interaction. This dynamic awareness creates authentic connection, whether on stage with fellow actors or in everyday conversations. Without responsive listening, we remain trapped in our own heads, making assumptions and missing the humanity of the person before us. I experienced this firsthand during my first scientific interview about solar panels, where I made 3 critical mistakes. Assuming knowledge I didn't have, ignoring the scientist's body language when I touched his delicate equipment, and failing to build questions from his answers. I wasn't truly listening with my eyes to facial expressions, with my ears to words, or with my feelings to emotional undercurrents. My journey with improvisation began with comedy sketches in a Hyannisport basement cabaret, but deepened through Paul Sill's workshop based on Viola Spaulin's techniques. This rigorous training wasn't about comedy, but about developing spontaneous connection with other actors. Through games and exercises, I learned true relating and responsive listening, fundamental skills for both stage and life. Responsive listening means letting the other person have an effect on you. In acting, this creates authentic performances where lines emerge naturally from genuine reactions rather than planned behavior. It's the difference between looking like you're acting versus creating something that looks like life. This same principle applies beyond the stage. Real conversation can't happen if listening is just waiting for your turn to speak. After my early fumbles interviewing scientists, I embraced my natural ignorance and curiosity rather than pretending knowledge. This approach helped scientists see exactly what I understood, allowing them to meet me where I was and communicate more effectively. When I truly listened with curiosity rather than prepared questions, it created a dynamic relationship. My responsive listening proved contagious. Scientists became more responsive themselves, relating to me as a person rather than a camera. They abandoned technical jargon, revealing their humanity and even humor. After Scientific American Frontiers ended, I decided to experiment with using improvisation to help scientists communicate better. At USC, I worked with 20 engineering students, having them give 2-minute talks about their work, then leading them through 3 hours of improv games, before asking them to present again. The results were remarkable. Students who had been stiff, jargon-heavy, or PowerPoint-dependent transformed into engaged communicators who could connect with their audience. In our improvisation exercises, engineering students learned that communication is fundamentally collaborative. Through games like creating imaginary sculptures together or joining physical activities without verbal explanation, they discovered how to observe others closely and build on what they contribute. These exercises taught them that communication isn't just about telling someone something, it's about tracking their ability to follow you and responding accordingly. The transformation in their presentations afterward was dramatic, with previously self-conscious students now making eye contact and speaking from the heart rather than hiding behind slides. Though I knew these changes wouldn't be permanent after just one session, the experience revealed the potential for improvisation to help even guarded, technical people open up and connect with audiences. This success sparked my vision of training scientists to communicate effectively while still in school. Eventually, Stony Brook University's president, Shirley Strum Kenny, proved receptive, and with help from journalism dean Howard Schneider and funding secured through Congressman Steve Israel, we established the Center for Communicating Science. When communicating complex ideas, we must recognize that our audience processes information through both rational thought and emotional response, much like Thomas Jefferson's famous dialogue between head and heart in his letter to Maria Causeway. Jefferson's characters bat arguments back and forth, with heart eventually proposing collaboration. Help me in my softer aims, and I'll help soften the edges of your science. This peace treaty between emotion and reason forms the core of effective communication. True connection happens when we see others both emotionally and rationally, including listening with our eyes for facial cues and gestures. This requires empathy, understanding feelings, and theory of mind, awareness of thoughts, two different but overlapping faculties. Mirror neurons may explain our empathic abilities. When we see someone grasp something, the same neurons fire in our brain as in theirs, potentially allowing us to predict intentions. Though some scientists debate their exact role, clearly some brain mechanism enables empathy. Theory of mind develops around age 5, when children realize others have different thoughts from their own. Before this, children assume everyone knows what they know, not realizing deception is even possible. This ability to understand others' mental states becomes essential throughout life, forming the foundation for meaningful communication. The mirror exercise demonstrates how attentive observation leads to connection. Two people stand face to face, with one person initiating movements the other must mirror perfectly. Initially, participants struggle with timing, but soon learn a fundamental principle. The communicator bears responsibility for the listener's understanding. If someone doesn't follow your explanation, slowing down becomes your job, not theirs. The exercise grows more challenging when roles reverse, and even more so when neither person leads. They must find movement together. Surprisingly, participants discover they can achieve instantaneous synchrony through close attention to subtle physical cues. Taking mirroring to another level, participants attempt to speak the exact same improvised words simultaneously. Despite initial frustration and significant lag times, they eventually achieve remarkable synchrony by focusing intensely on each other's eyes, lips, and body language. Research from Stanford University by Wiltermuth and Heath reveals why armies still train by marching in step despite its tactical obsolescence. Synchronous movement strengthens group cohesion and promotes cooperation. Their study showed that groups who walked in step scored higher on trust and cooperation tests compared to control groups. Even simple tapping in sync produced similar results. Increasing attention to group welfare, reducing selfish choices, and creating feelings of similarity that fostered compassion and altruistic behavior. While our grad students attempted leaderless synchronization, scientists at Israel's Weizmann Institute were testing if such coordination was possible. Yuri alone designed an experiment measuring mirroring with handles on tracks. The results were remarkable. Experienced improvisers achieved more rapid and synchronized movements during joint improvisation without designated leaders than when following leader-follower roles. This confirmed what improv practitioners have long sensed. True synchrony brings us together most powerfully when no one leads. Synchrony requires acute observation, which is why improv training begins with exercises that heighten awareness of subtle behavioral shifts. These games develop the ability to see and respond to the slightest changes in another person's movements and expressions. In gibberish exercises, participants must communicate without using real language, forcing them to rely on body language, demonstrations, and emotional expression. Initially intimidating, this practice quickly reveals how we can connect meaningfully without words. The experience becomes pleasurable as people discover their capacity to communicate with their whole expressive self rather than merely spraying words at listeners. Another powerful exercise is What's the Relationship? This variation of Viola Spolin's Who Am I? Challenges participants to convey relationships purely through manner and behavior, not content. A scientist might describe her research while subtly communicating whether she's speaking to her boss, child, or colleague, without using obvious verbal hints. Dr. Martha Furie demonstrated this brilliantly when portraying someone confronting an estranged sister having an affair with her husband. These exercises reveal multiple ways to express the same information depending on audience, while teaching participants to read and convey meaning through nonverbal cues. Even experienced actors find these improvisations transformative, as when an actress playing a character from Dürrenmatt's The Visit achieved profound emotional depth after improvising a traumatic backstory scene not written in the play. The experience isn't acting in the conventional sense. There's no pretending, just intimate connection in the present moment that creates empathy, the bedrock of effective communication. When Bob Kahn of the Kavli Foundation urged me to work with senior scientists already communicating with the public, it led to breakthrough moments like David Muller's experience at Cornell. Muller, who had created the world's thinnest glass, one molecule thick, discovered a new way to talk about his work when faced with non-scientist listeners in my workshop. By emphasizing the accidental nature of his discovery and the Guinness World Record recognition, Muller found entry points that resonated emotionally with laypeople. This human connection transformed his story from one that interested only technical journals to one picked up by media worldwide and even attracting venture capitalists. Muller learned to take responsibility for how well his listeners followed his story, using empathy and theory of mind, natural strengths that are often underutilized in communication. Psychiatrist Helen Ries revolutionized doctor-patient relationships through a study measuring both parties' emotional responses via skin conductance monitors. In a session with a college student struggling with weight loss, Ries discovered her patient's tracings showed massive anxiety spikes that didn't match her composed exterior. Reviewing video footage, Ries identified subtle physical leaks of emotion. Hair tosses, sudden chortles that she'd missed during their session. This revelation allowed Ries to respond more effectively to her patient's hidden emotions, ultimately helping her lose nearly 50 pounds. Ries teaches doctors to avoid affective quicksand, becoming so overwhelmed by a patient's emotions that they lose therapeutic effectiveness. She explains that while we're wired to read other people's minds and get under a patient's skin, doctors must also get back out by regulating their emotional responses. Balanced empathy without quicksand creates the therapeutic connection essential for clear communication with any audience. Matt Lerner's approach to teaching social skills to teens on the autism spectrum evolved when he realized conventional methods weren't working. After his students rejected rigid, manual-based instructions like look them in the eye, but not for too long, Matt collaborated with actor friends to develop improvisation games. These exercises, mirroring, tossing imaginary balls, reading body language, immediately engaged the previously resistant teens. Rather than following scripts, they practiced spontaneity through activities they found interesting, including countless lightsaber fights. The program, called Spotlight, proved so successful that Matt conducted controlled studies measuring empathy before and after improv training, tracking friendship development, and documenting social skills improvement. Now serving over 350 children annually in Boston, the program demonstrates how theatrical techniques can build genuine social connection. Research shows that a team's success depends less on individual intelligence than on three key factors: members' ability to participate freely in discussions, their empathy scores, and the presence of women in the group. Anita Woolley's study of 697 volunteers found that women's typically higher empathy ratings contributed significantly to team performance. This held true whether teams worked face-to-face or online. Companies like Alibaba, where 34% of senior management are women, have intentionally leveraged this secret sauce. While a 15-year study of S&P firms showed companies with women in top positions performed better, particularly those focused on innovation. Yuri Alone, the scientist who demonstrated leaderless mirroring, applies improvisational theater principles to enhance scientific teamwork. Rejecting the notion that students are solely responsible for their motivation, Alone creates conditions that nurture self-motivated behavior. His lab team begins weekly meetings with 30 minutes of non-scientific conversation about art, politics, or personal experiences before discussing research. This social connectedness dramatically improves motivation and collaboration. The fundamental improv principle of yes and has transformed Yuri Alone's scientific work. Rather than blocking ideas, that's not water, that's the stage. Alone encourages acceptance and constructive building upon suggestions. Wow, what a lot of water! Let's jump in! When a frustrated student wished they could just make a diagram on a piece of paper, Alone responded, "Yes, and let's do it on a really huge piece of paper." This openness led to a breakthrough discovery that genes interact in just three basic patterns repeated throughout cells, simplifying what had seemed hopelessly complex. Effective communication begins before you speak by considering your audience's existing knowledge and interests. When explaining complex topics like the Higgs boson discovery at CERN, understanding your listener's starting point is essential. This empathetic preparation helps determine how deep to go, what concepts need explanation, and what information your audience is eager to learn. Starting too far into a complex topic can overwhelm listeners, while providing clear, homey examples, like Brian Greene's bread analogy for particles, makes concepts memorable. Sometimes people need presence more than knowledge, especially in vulnerable situations. Communication is central to effective leadership. While I have limited experience managing large teams, successful CEOs like Warren Buffett demonstrate the power of clear, concise communication. Buffett, once terrified of public speaking, now communicates effectively with 330,000 employees through brief, direct messages rather than lengthy manuals. Research confirms that empathetic leaders get better results. Those rated highly for empathy by subordinates are viewed as better performers by their bosses. Most of us have communication blind spots we're unaware of. In corporate settings, this can create dangerous vulnerabilities. When technical experts like IT security officers fail to translate their knowledge for board members, critical information gets lost. The responsibility for clear communication lies with the sender, not the receiver. Overwhelming audiences with excessive technical details creates roadblocks. Sometimes providing just enough information to spark interest is more effective than force-feeding every detail. Selling isn't confined to business transactions, but occurs constantly in human interactions. I initially viewed selling as manipulation until experiencing a revelation. Effective selling means helping others get what they need, rather than focusing on one's own agenda. When a masseuse approached me about investing in his mutual fund, I shifted from self-focused pitching to genuinely engaging with her needs, transforming my approach to sales. Social awareness, a concept introduced by psychologist Edward Thorndike and developed in Daniel Goleman's work on emotional intelligence, involves three progressive steps: empathic awareness of another's inner state, grasping their thoughts and feelings, and understanding complex social situations. This empathetic approach distinguishes exceptional salespeople who can identify customers' unstated needs and match them with appropriate solutions. Petty annoyances in relationships accumulate, but deeper listening can reduce friction. Research shows couples sharing housework equitably have more frequent and satisfying sex, yet only 30% of men share housework equally. Empathy increases cooperation. When a partner imagines how the other feels seeing unwashed dishes, they're more motivated to help. The sound of certainty, that triumphant tone announcing, "I know what I'm talking about," kills cooperation by closing doors to dialogue. Even well-intentioned communication techniques like active listening can backfire if delivered with hostile undertones. Authentic connection produces natural changes in tone and expression that can't be consciously manufactured, unlike the scripted friendliness of hotel clerks. During the 11 years filming MASH, the cast discovered a transformative approach to creating authentic connection. Rather than retreating to separate dressing rooms between shots, they sat together in a circle, laughing and maintaining engagement. This continuous connection carried into filming, giving their performances a jolt of life. Even musicians benefit from this kind of connection. Stanley and Naomi Drucker of the New York Philharmonic draw energy from audience engagement, while Yo-Yo Ma connects with fellow musicians before performances. Helen Reese transformed her approach to patient care after discovering she'd missed her patients' emotional fluctuations and now trains other doctors to develop greater empathy. She begins by teaching that empathy can indeed be learned, introducing doctors to the neuroscience behind it, the brain's ability to enter the mind of others through theory of mind. While this concept is fundamental in psychotherapy, it's rarely taught in medical school as a clinical tool. The key to developing empathy is utilizing the brain's ability to reflect another person's experience through affective resonance, the feeling of connectedness we achieve through eye contact and unconsciously synchronizing our bodies. When we're truly tuned into someone, these mirror functions happen automatically, allowing us to share their emotions. Reese recommends asking patients what they think is causing their problem. This creates deeper connection and yields surprising insights. A pediatrician shared how her professor, as a junior doctor facing a difficult case, simply asked the patient what he thought was wrong. The patient suggested malaria, something that hadn't occurred to the medical team. Tests confirmed the diagnosis was correct. This cognitive empathy is an important first step in emotional resonance with patients, helping doctors sense whether patients are at ease. Doctors must avoid getting overwhelmed by patients' emotions and sinking into affective quicksand. Self-regulation is essential. You recognize the other person's emotion in yourself, but don't act it out. You take responsibility for managing your own feelings while maintaining empathic connection. Research shows acting training significantly increases empathy. Studies by Thalia Goldstein and Ellen Winner found both elementary and high school students trained in acting showed substantial gains in empathy scores, with adolescents showing additional improvement in theory of mind. Unlike music or visual arts training, only theater training produced these results. Most importantly, empathy training produces real-world benefits. Patients of empathetic doctors are 19% more likely to follow medical recommendations and show measurable health improvements. Dr. Kaplan List brings unique perspective as former child actress, journalist, pediatrician, and 21-time surgery patient. Her communication advice transforms medical practice, as demonstrated by an anesthesiologist who now begins patient interactions with, "I'm here to keep you safe and comfortable," rather than technical details. This simple change makes patients visibly relax. Emotions don't just make communication more engaging, they make it more memorable. Memory researcher Jim McGaw explained to me that we remember events tied to strong emotions, any emotion, not just fear. "I bet if I asked you to remember your first kiss, you'd be able to," he said, proving his point when I instantly recalled my awkward 12-year-old spin-the-bottle experience. Whether it's winning a Nobel Prize or experiencing something traumatic, emotional events lodge in our memory. In McGaw's lab, I witnessed how stress hormones enhance memory formation. As subjects who plunge their arms in ice water after viewing emotionally charged images remembered them better a week later. This consolidation process helps our brains prioritize important memories. Neuroscientist Lorna Roll confirmed this theory about emotional memories by recalling her own traumatic first kiss. We both had braces. We locked. Beyond trauma, she experiences profound emotion in scientific discovery, vividly remembering where she stood when first seeing single-channel receptor recordings in nature. That was hallelujah chorus stuff, she explained passionately. I tell people if they don't hear the hallelujah chorus when they do this work, they shouldn't be a biophysicist. Fear creates particularly potent memories. Lorna explained that in her research, fear conditioning is remarkably efficient. It only takes one trial, one pairing of a sound with a shock for the animal so that the next time they hear that sound, they're like, oh, shock. This evolutionary advantage makes sense. You don't get multiple chances with predators. Though fear was studied first because it's easily demonstrated, both positive and negative emotional experiences affect memory formation. The amygdala processes both positive and negative emotional experiences. When I asked how to excite emotions in untrained audiences, Lorna immediately answered, story. She referenced my Chilean medical emergency story where a surgeon performed an end-to-end anastomosis but explained it simply as, we have to cut out the bad part and sew the two good ends together. This story resonates with medical audiences far better than abstract advice about avoiding jargon. Stories naturally carry emotional weight that makes information memorable. Don Hewitt, creator of 60 Minutes, had a simple rule that kept the show atop ratings for decades. Whenever producers pitched segments about issues, laws, or scams, he'd interrupt with four words, "Tell me a story." The show's success came from transforming complex topics into stories about individual spies or whistleblowers. This approach works because storytelling is deeply embedded in human cognition. My friend Graham Ched, with whom I'd worked on science programs for 20 years and who saved my life in Chile, teaches storytelling by showing footage from our Yale experiment with 6-month-old Nora. The baby watched geometric shapes with button eyes acting out a scenario. A red disc struggling up a mountain, a yellow triangle pushing it down, and a blue square helping it up. When offered a choice afterward, Nora immediately reached for the helpful blue square. Graham suggested the baby was interpreting this as a story, and researcher Karen Wynn confirmed, in order to sense meaning, there has to be a narrative. Even at 6 months old, babies follow events in context, suggesting our storytelling instinct emerges in infancy. Princeton neuroscientist Yuri Hossam's research reveals how stories literally couple our brains. In his experiments, someone watches a movie in an fMRI machine, then tells the story of that movie while being scanned. The same brain areas activate during both watching and retelling. Most remarkably, when others merely listen to the recorded story, their brains activate in the same patterns, moment by moment, as though they were watching the original movie themselves. Storytelling is amazing, Yuri told me. It has the power to make people really aligned and more effective passing information between them. I've experienced this myself at dinner parties. When I recite dry facts about my work with scientists, eyes glaze over. But when I tell a story about a medical student helping a patient understand her diagnosis, people lean in and want to know more. What makes a compelling narrative is when the middle section goes into a different gear. What truly engages us is what Aristotle identified in Oedipus Rex, dramatic action. The hero pursues something of great importance but encounters obstacles that create tension. We identify with someone who has a goal, but we root for someone with both a goal and an obstacle. Even essays can be enlivened by oppositional force, proposing an idea and then countering it with an opposing thought. Lincoln's Gettysburg Address exemplifies this. 67 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Then, the opposing thought. Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation or any nation so conceived and so dedicated can long endure. Communication is like improvisation. There's no failing, only the next step toward an interesting resolution. The ashes of failure can be where the phoenix rises. Scientists fail better when seeking more truth rather than absolute truth. And we all improve when we embrace life's improvisational nature, seeing conversations as exchanges where others might have better perspectives, creating a dance with partners rather than wrestling with opponents. True communication isn't about following formulas or diagrams, like childhood foxtrot instructions that showed where to place feet but never taught anyone to truly dance. Instead, it requires personal transformation. When we sync with someone, even briefly, it creates a pleasure similar to reconciliation. Moving from opposition to understanding triggers dopamine release. The key is paying attention to what creates connection, not just mechanical techniques like changing pace or volume, but the fundamental source, reading the other person's face. As I learned with my 6-year-old grandson, Mateo, even with the best intentions, we must truly read the other person. My lengthy explanation about evolution after seeing a thorny tree completely missed the mark with him, as he later declared he wouldn't make that mistake again of asking me science questions. According to neuroscientist Yuri Hossen, effective storytelling relies heavily on commonality between storyteller and listener. When people share similarities, their minds literally sync up more effectively in brain scans. The storyteller activates the listener's existing knowledge, helping them construct understanding from familiar elements arranged in new ways. The more commonalities people share, educational, geographical, cultural, the better the communication. In the end, communication isn't just about transferring information. It's about creating genuine human connection through empathy, attention, and shared experience. When we truly relate to others, allowing ourselves to be changed by the interaction, we open the door to understanding that transforms both parties. This dance of understanding, this willingness to see the world through another's eyes, is the foundation of all meaningful communication.